But a moment later, I caught myself. I had fallen into the apartheid mindset, thinking Africans were inferior and that flying was a white man's job. I sat back in my seat and chided myself for such thoughts. Once we were in the air, I lost my nervousness and studied the geography of Ethiopia, thinking how guerrilla forces hid in these very forests to fight the Italian imperialists. Chapter 47. Formerly known as Abyssinia, Ethiopia, according to tradition, was founded long before the birth of Christ, supposedly by the son of Solomon and the queen of Sheba. Although it had been conquered dozens of times, Ethiopia was the birthplace of African nationalism. Unlike so many other African states, it had fought colonialism at every turn. Menelik had rebuffed the Italians in the last century, though Ethiopia failed to halt them in this one. In 1930, Haile Selassie became emperor and the shaping force of contemporary Ethiopian history. I was 17 when Mussolini attacked Ethiopia, an invasion that spurred not only my hatred of that despot, but of fascism in general. Although Selassie was forced to flee when the Italians conquered Ethiopia in 1936, he returned after Allied forces drove the Italians out in 1941. Ethiopia has always held a special place in my own imagination, and the prospect of visiting Ethiopia attracted me more strongly than a trip to France, England, and America combined. I felt I would be visiting my own genesis, unearthing the roots of what made me an African. Meeting the emperor himself would be like shaking hands with history. Our first stop was Addis Ababa, the imperial city, which did not live up to its title, for it was the opposite of grand, with only a few tarred streets and more goats and sheep than cars. Apart from the imperial palace, the university, and the Ras Hotel, where we stayed, there were few structures that could compare with even the least impressive buildings of Johannesburg. Contemporary Ethiopia was not a model when it came to democracy, either. There were no political parties, no popular organs of government, no separation of powers, only the emperor, who was supreme. Before the opening of the conference, the delegates assembled at the town of Debre Zaid. A grandstand had been erected in the central square, and Oliver and I sat off to the side, away from the main podium. Suddenly, we heard the distant music of a lone bugle, and then the strains of a brass band accompanied by the steady beating of African drums. As the music came closer, I could hear and feel the rumbling of hundreds of marching feet. From behind a building at the edge of the square, an officer appeared brandishing a gleaming sword. At his heels marched 500 black soldiers in rows four across, each carrying a polished rifle against his uniformed shoulder. When the troops had marched directly in front of the grandstand, an order rang out in Amharic, and the 500 soldiers halted as one man spun around and executed a precise salute to an elderly man in a dazzling uniform. His Highness the Emperor of Ethiopia, Haile Selassie, the Lion of Judah. Here, for the first time in my life, I was witnessing black soldiers commanded by black generals, applauded by black leaders who were all guests of a black head of state. It was a heady moment. I only hoped it was a vision of what lay in the future for my own country. On the morning after the parade, Oliver and I attended a meeting where each organization had to apply for accreditation. We were unpleasantly surprised to find that our application was blocked by a delegate from Uganda, who complained that we were a tribal organization of Xhosas. My impulse was to dismiss this claim contemptuously, but Oliver's notion was that we should simply explain that our organization was formed to unite Africans and our membership was drawn from all sections of the people. This I did, adding that the president of our organization, Chief Lutuli, was a Zulu. Our application was accepted. I realized that many people on the continent only knew about the ANC from the PAC's description of us. The conference was officially opened by our host, His Imperial Majesty, who was dressed in an elaborate brocaded army uniform. I was surprised by how small the emperor appeared, but his dignity and confidence made him seem like the African giant that he was. It was the first time I had witnessed a head of state go through the formalities of his office, and I was fascinated. He stood perfectly straight and inclined his head only slightly to indicate that he was listening. Dignity was the hallmark of all his actions. I was scheduled to speak after the emperor, the only other speaker that morning. For the first time in many months, I flung aside the identity of David Motsamai and became Nelson Mandela. In my speech, I reviewed the history of the freedom struggle in South Africa and listed the brutal massacres that had been committed against our people, from Bulhoek in 1921, when the army and police killed 183 unarmed peasants, to Sharpeville 40 years later. I thanked the assembled nations for exerting pressure on South Africa, citing in particular Ghana, Nigeria, and Tanganyika, who spearheaded the successful drive to oust South Africa from the British Commonwealth. I retraced the birth of Umkhonto Wesizwe, explaining that all opportunities for peaceful struggle had been closed to us. A leadership commits a crime against its own people if it hesitates to sharpen its political weapons where they have become less effective. On the night of 16 December last year, the whole of South Africa vibrated under the heavy blows of Umkhonto Wesizwe. I had no sooner said this than the Chief Minister of Uganda cried out, "Give it to them again!" I then related my own experience. I have just come out of South Africa, having for the last 10 months lived in my own country as an outlaw, away from family and friends. When I was compelled to lead this sort of life, I made a public statement in which I announced that I would not leave the country, but would continue working underground. I meant it, and I will honor that undertaking. The announcement that I would return to South Africa was met with loud cheers. We had been encouraged to speak first so PAF Mexa could evaluate our cause and decide how much support to give it. There was a natural reluctance among many African states to support violent struggles elsewhere, but the speech convinced people that freedom fighters in South Africa had no alternative but to take up arms. Oliver and I had a private discussion with Kenneth Konda, the leader of the United National Independence Party of Northern Rhodesia and the future president of Zambia. Like Julius Nyerere, Konda was worried about the lack of unity among South African freedom fighters and suggested that when Sobukwe emerged from jail, we might all join forces. Among Africans, the PAC had captured the spotlight at Sharpeville in a way that far exceeded their influence as an organization. Konda, who had once been a member of the ANC, told us he was concerned about our alliance with white communists and indicated that this reflected poorly on us in Africa. Communism was suspect not only in the West, but in Africa. This came as something of a revelation to me, and it was a view that I was to hear over and over during my trip. When I attempted to make the case that UNIP's support of the PAC was misguided, Konda put his hand on my shoulder and said, "Nelson, speaking to me on this subject is like carrying coals to Newcastle. I am your supporter and a follower of Chief Lituli, but I am not the sole voice of UNIP. You must speak to Simon Kapwepwe. If you persuade him, you will make my job easier." Kapwepwe was the second in command of UNIP, and I made arrangements to see him the following day. I asked Oliver to join me, but he said, "Nell, you must see him on your own. Then you can be completely frank." I spent the entire day with Kapwepwe and heard from him the most astonishing tale. "We were mightily impressed by your speech," he said, "and indeed by your entire ANC delegation. If we were to judge your organization by these two things, we would certainly be in your camp. But we have heard disturbing reports from the PAC to the effect that Umkhonto we Sizwe is the brainchild of the Communist Party and the Liberal Party, and that the idea of the organization is merely to use Africans as cannon fodder. I was nonplussed, and I blurted out that I was astounded that he could not see himself how damnably false this story was. First of all, I said, it is well known that the Liberal Party and the Communist Party are arch-enemies and could not come together to form a game of cards. Second, I am here to tell you at the risk of immodesty that I myself was the prime mover behind MK's formation. Finally, I said I was greatly disappointed in the PAC for spreading such lies. By the end of the day, I had converted Kapwepwe, and he said he would call a meeting and make our case himself. And he did so. But it was another example of both the lack of knowledge about South Africa in the rest of Africa and the extraordinary lengths the PAC would go to besmirch the ANC. Kapwepwe bade me good luck, for the conference was now over. It had been successful, but we had our work cut out for us. As a student, I had fantasized about visiting Egypt, the cradle of African civilization, the treasure chest of so much beauty in art and design, about seeing the pyramids and the Sphinx, and crossing the Nile, the greatest of African rivers. From Addis, Oliver, Robert Rescher, who was to accompany me on the rest of my travels, and I flew to Cairo. I spent the whole morning of my first day in Cairo at the museum, looking at art, examining artifacts, making notes, learning about the type of men who founded the ancient civilization of the Nile Valley. This was not amateur archaeological interest. It is important for African nationalists to be armed with evidence to dispute the fictitious claims of whites that Africans are without a civilized past that compares with that of the West. In a single morning, I discovered that Egyptians were still creating great works of art and architecture when whites were still living in caves. Egypt was an important model for us, for we could witness firsthand the program of socialist economic reforms being launched by President Nasser. He had reduced private ownership of land, nationalized certain sectors of the economy, pioneered rapid industrialization, democratized education, and built a modern army. Many of these reforms were precisely the sort of things that we in the ANC someday hoped to enact. At that time, however, it was more important to us that Egypt was the only African state with an army, navy, and air force that could in any way compare with those of South Africa. After a day, Oliver left for London, promising to join Robbie and me in Ghana. Before Robbie and I left on our tour, we discussed the presentation we would make in each country. My inclination was to explain the political situation as truthfully and objectively as possible, and not omit the accomplishments of the PAC. In each new country, I would initially seal myself away in our hotel, familiarizing myself with information about the country's policies, history, and leadership. Robbie did the opposite. A natural extrovert, he would leave the hotel as soon as we arrived and hit the streets, learning by seeing and talking to people. We were an odd couple, for I affected the informal dress I had gotten used to underground and wore khakis and fatigues, while Robbie was always smartly turned out in a suit. In Tunis, our first stop, we met with the Minister of Defense, who bore a striking resemblance to Chief Letuli. But I'm afraid that is where the similarity ended, for when I was explaining to him the situation in our country with PAC leaders such as Robert Sobukwe in jail, he interrupted me and said, "When that chap returns, he will finish you." Robbie raised his eyebrows at this. Later he said, "Man, you were putting the case for the PAC better than they could." But I insisted on giving the minister the full picture. When we met the following day with President Habib Bourguiba, his response was utterly positive and immediate. He offered training for our soldiers and £5,000 for weapons. Rabat in Morocco, our next stop, with its ancient and mysterious walls, its fashionable shops, and its medieval mosques, seemed a charming mixture of Africa, Europe, and the Middle East. Apparently, freedom fighters thought so as well, for Rabat was the crossroads of virtually every liberation movement on the continent. While there, we met with freedom fighters from Mozambique, Angola, Algeria, and Cape Verde. It was also the headquarters of the Algerian Revolutionary Army, and we spent several days with Dr. Mustafa, head of the Algerian mission in Morocco, who briefed us on the history of the Algerian resistance to the French. The situation in Algeria was the closest model to our own, in that the rebels faced a large white settler community that ruled the indigenous majority. He related how the FLN had begun their struggle with a handful of guerrilla attacks in 1954, having been heartened by the defeat of the French at Dien Bien Phu in Vietnam. At first, the FLN believed they could defeat the French militarily, Dr. Mustafa said, then realized that a pure military victory was impossible. Instead, they resorted to guerrilla warfare. Guerrilla warfare, he explained, was not designed to win a military victory so much as to unleash political and economic forces that would bring down the enemy. Dr. Mustafa counseled us not to neglect the political side of war while planning the military effort. International public opinion, he said, is sometimes worth more than a fleet of jet fighters. At the end of 3 days, he sent us to Oujda, a dusty little town right across the border from Algeria, and the headquarters of the Algerian army in Morocco. We visited an army unit at the front, and at one point I took a pair of field glasses and could actually see French troops across the border. I confess I imagined that I was looking at the uniforms of the South African Defense Force. A day or two later, I was a guest at a military parade in honor of Ahmed Ben Bella, who was to become the first Prime Minister of independent Algeria and who had recently emerged from a French prison. A far cry from the military parade I had witnessed in Addis Ababa, this parade was not the crisp, well-drilled, handsomely uniformed force of Ethiopia, but a kind of walking history of the guerrilla movement in Algeria. At its head sauntered proud, battle-hardened veterans in turbans, long tunics, and sandals, who had started the struggle many years before. They carried the weapons they had used, sabers, old flintlock rifles, battle axes, and assegais. They were followed in turn by younger soldiers, all carrying modern arms and equally proud. Some held heavy anti-tank and anti-aircraft guns. But even these soldiers did not march with the smartness and precision of the Ethiopians. This was a guerrilla force, and they were soldiers who had won their stripes in the fire of battle, who cared more about fighting and tactics than dress uniforms and parades. As inspired as I was by the troops in Addis, I knew that our own force would be more like these troops here in Oujda, and I could only hope that they would fight as valiantly. At the rear was a rather ragtag military band that was led by a man called Sudani. Tall, well-built, and confident, he was as black as the night. He was swinging a ceremonial mace, and when we saw him, our whole party stood up and started clapping and cheering. I looked around and noticed others staring at us, and I realized that we were only cheering because this fellow was a black man, and black faces were quite rare in Morocco. Once again I was struck by the great power of nationalism and ethnicity. We reacted instantly, for we felt as though we were seeing a brother African. Later, our hosts informed us that Sudani had become a legendary soldier and had even reputedly captured an entire French unit single-handedly. But we were cheering him because of his color, not his exploits. From Morocco, I flew across the Sahara to Bamako, the capital of Mali, and then on to Guinea. The flight from Mani to Guinea was more like a local bus than an airplane. Chickens wandered the aisles. Women walked back and forth carrying packages on their heads and selling bags of peanuts and dried vegetables. It was flying democratic style, and I admired it very much. My next stop was Sierra Leone, and when I arrived, I discovered that Parliament was in session and decided to attend the proceedings. I entered as any tourist would and was given a seat not far from the speaker. The clerk of the house approached me and asked me to identify myself. I whispered to him, "I am the representative of Chief Lithuli of South Africa." He shook my hand warmly and proceeded to report to the speaker. The clerk then explained that I had inadvertently been given a seat not normally allowed to visitors, but in this case it was an honor for them to make an exception. Within an hour there was an adjournment, and as I stood among the members and dignitaries drinking tea, a queue formed in front of me, and I saw to my amazement that the entire Parliament had lined up to shake hands with me. I was very gratified until the third or fourth person in line mumbled something to the effect of, "It is a great honor to shake the hand of the revered Chief Lithuli, winner of the Nobel Peace Prize." I was an imposter. The clerk had misunderstood. The Prime Minister, Sir Milton Margai, was then brought over to meet me, and the clerk introduced me as the chief. I immediately attempted to inform the clerk that I was not Chief Lithuli, but the fellow would have none of it, and I decided that in the interests of hospitality, I would continue the charade. I later met with the president, explained the case of mistaken identity, and he offered generous material assistance. In Liberia, I met with President Tubman, who not only gave me $5,000 for weapons and training, but said in a quiet voice, "Have you any pocket money?" I confessed that I was a bit low, and instantly an aide came back with an envelope containing $400 in cash. From Liberia, I went to Ghana, where I was met by Oliver and entertained by Guinea's resident minister, Abdoulaye Diallo. When I told him that I had not seen Sekou Touré when I was in Guinea, he arranged for us to return immediately to that arid land. Oliver and I were impressed with Touré. He lived in a modest bungalow and wore an old faded suit that could have used a visit to the dry cleaners. We made our case to him, explained the history of the ANC and MK, and asked for $5,000 for the support of MK. He listened very carefully and replied in a rather formal way. "The government and the people of Guinea," he said as though giving a speech, "fully support the struggle of our brothers in South Africa, and we have made statements at the UN to that effect." He went to the bookcase where he removed two books of his, which he autographed to Oliver and me. He then said, "Thank you," and we were dismissed. Oliver and I were annoyed. We had been called back from another country, and all he gave us were signed copies of his book. We had wasted our time. A short while later, we were in our hotel room, when an official from the Foreign Affairs Department knocked on our door and presented us with a suitcase. We opened it, and it was filled with banknotes. Oliver and I looked at each other in glee. But then Oliver's expression changed. "Nelson, this is Guinean currency," he said. "It is worthless outside of here. It is just paper." But Oliver had an idea. We took the money to the Czech embassy, where he had a friend who exchanged it for a convertible currency. The gracefulness of the slender fishing boats that glided into the harbor in Dakar was equaled only by the elegance of the Senegalese women who sailed through the city in flowing robes and turbaned heads. I wandered through the nearby marketplace, intoxicated by the exotic spices and perfumes. The Senegalese are a handsome people, and I enjoyed the brief time that Oliver and I spent in their country. Their society showed how disparate elements, French, Islamic, and African, can mingle to create a unique and distinctive culture. On our way to a meeting with President Leopold Senghor, Oliver suffered a severe attack of asthma. He refused to return to the hotel, and I carried him on my back up the stairs to the president's office. Senghor was greatly concerned by Oliver's condition and insisted that he be attended to by his personal physician. I had been told to be wary of Senghor, for there were reports that Senegalese soldiers were serving with the French in Algeria, and that President Senghor was a bit too taken with the customs and charms of the ancient regime. There will always be, in emerging nations, an enduring attraction to the ways of the colonizer. I myself was not immune to it. President Senghor was a scholar and a poet, and he told us he was collecting research material on Shaka, flattering us by asking numerous questions about that great South African warrior. We summarized the situation in South Africa and made our request for military training and money. Senghor replied that his hands were tied until Parliament met. In the meantime, he wanted us to talk with the Minister of Justice, a Mr. Dabusier, about military training, and the President introduced me to a beautiful white French girl who, he explained, would interpret for me in my meeting with him. I said nothing, but was disturbed. I did not feel comfortable discussing the very sensitive issues of military training in front of a young woman I did not know and was not sure I could trust. Senghor sensed my uneasiness, for he said, "Mandela, do not worry. The French here identify themselves completely with our African aspirations." When we reached the minister's office, we found some African secretaries in the reception area. One of the black secretaries asked the French woman what she was doing here. She said she had been sent by the president to interpret. An argument ensued, and in the middle of it, one of the African secretaries turned to me and said, "Sir, can you speak English?" I said I could, and she replied, "The minister speaks English, and you can talk with him directly. You don't need an interpreter." The French girl, now quite miffed, stood aside as I went in to speak to the minister, who promised to fulfill our requests. In the end, although Senghor did not then provide us with what we asked for, he furnished me with a diplomatic passport and paid for our plane fares from Dakar to our next destination, London. Chapter 48. I confess to being something of an Anglophile. When I thought of Western democracy and freedom, I thought of the British parliamentary system. In so many ways, the very model of the gentleman for me was an Englishman. Despite Britain being the home of parliamentary democracy, it was that democracy that had helped inflict a pernicious system of iniquity on my people. While I abhorred the notion of British imperialism, I never rejected the trappings of British style and manners. I had several reasons for wanting to go to England, apart from my desire to see the country I had so long read and heard about. I was concerned about Oliver's health and wanted to persuade him to receive treatment. I very much wanted to see Adelaide, his wife, and their children, as well as Yusuf Dadu, who was now living there and representing the Congress movement. I also knew that in London I would be able to obtain literature on guerrilla warfare that I had been unable to acquire elsewhere. I resumed my old underground ways in London, not wanting word to leak back to South Africa that I was there. The tentacles of South African security forces reached all the way to London. But I was not a recluse. My 10 days there were divided among ANC business, seeing old friends, and occasional jaunts as a conventional tourist. With Mary Benson, a Pretoria-born friend who had written about our struggle, Oliver and I saw the sights of the city that had once commanded nearly 2/3 of the globe, Westminster Abbey, Big Ben, the Houses of Parliament. While I gloried in the beauty of these buildings, I was ambivalent about what they represented. When we saw the statue of General Smuts near Westminster Abbey, Oliver and I joked that perhaps some day there would be a statue of us in its stead. I had been informed by numerous people that the Observer newspaper, run by David Astor, had been tilting toward the PAC in its coverage, editorializing that the ANC was the party of the past. Oliver arranged for me to meet Astor at his house, and we talked at length about the ANC. I do not know if I had an effect on him, but the coverage certainly changed. He also recommended that I talk to a number of prominent politicians, and in the company of Labour MP Dennis Healy, I met with Hugh Gaitskell, the leader of the Labour Party, and Joe Grimond, the leader of the Liberal Party. It was only toward the end of my stay that I saw Yusuf, but it was not a happy reunion. Oliver and I had encountered a recurring difficulty in our travels. One African leader after another had questioned us about our relations with white and Indian communists, sometimes suggesting that they controlled the ANC. Our non-racialism would have been less of a problem had it not been for the formation of the explicitly nationalistic and anti-white PAC. In the rest of Africa, most African leaders could understand the views of the PAC better than those of the ANC. Oliver had discussed these things with Yusuf, who was unhappy about Oliver's conclusions. Oliver had resolved that the ANC had to appear more independent, taking certain actions unilaterally without the involvement of the other members of the alliance, and I agreed. I spent my last night in London discussing these issues with Yusuf. I explained that now that we were embarking on an armed struggle, we would be relying on other African nations for money, training, and support, and therefore had to take their views into account more than we did in the past. Yusuf believed that Oliver and I were changing ANC policy, that we were preparing to depart from the non-racialism that was the core of the Freedom Charter. I told him he was mistaken. We were not rejecting non-racialism. We were simply saying that ANC must stand more on its own and make statements that were not part of the Congress alliance. Often, the ANC, the South African Indian Congress, and the Colored People's Congress would make a collective statement on an issue affecting only Africans. That would have to change. Yusuf was unhappy about this. "What about policy?" he kept asking. I told him I was not talking about policy, I was talking about image. We would still work together, only the ANC had to appear to be the first among equals. Although I was sad to leave my friends in London, I was now embarking on what was to be the most unfamiliar part of my trip, military training. I had arranged to receive 6 months of training in Addis Ababa. I was met there by Foreign Minister Yefu, who warmly greeted me and took me to a suburb called Kof, the headquarters of the Ethiopian Riot Battalion, where I was to learn the art and science of soldiering. While I was a fair amateur boxer, I had very little knowledge of even the rudiments of combat. My trainer was a Lieutenant Rondoni Befikadu, an experienced soldier who had fought with the underground against the Italians. Our program was strenuous. We trained from 8 a.m. until 1 p.m., broke for a shower and lunch, and then again from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. From 4 p.m. into the evening, I was lectured on military science by Colonel Tadesi, who was also Assistant Commissioner of Police and had been instrumental in foiling a recent coup attempt against the Emperor. I learned how to shoot an automatic rifle and a pistol and took target practice both in Kof with the Emperor's guard and at a shooting range about 50 miles away with the entire battalion. I was taught about demolition and mortar firing, and I learned how to make small bombs and mines, and how to avoid them. I felt myself being molded into a soldier, and began to think as a soldier thinks, a far cry from the way a politician thinks. What I enjoyed most were the fatigue marches, in which you are equipped with only a gun, bullets, and some water, and you must reach a distant point within a certain time. During these marches, I got a sense of the landscape, which was very beautiful, with dense forests and spare highlands. The country was extremely backward. People used wooden plows and lived on a very simple diet supplemented by home-brewed beer. Their existence was similar to the life in rural South Africa. Poor people everywhere are more alike than they are different. In my study sessions, Colonel Tadesi discussed matters such as how to create a guerrilla force, how to command an army, and how to enforce discipline. One evening, during supper, Colonel Tadesi said to me, "Now, Mandela, you are creating a liberation army, not a conventional capitalist army. A liberation army is an egalitarian army. You must treat your men entirely differently than you would in a capitalist army. When you are on duty, you must exercise your authority with assurance and control. That is no different from a capitalist command. But when you are off duty, you must conduct yourself on the basis of perfect equality, even with the lowliest soldier. You must eat what they eat. You must not take your food in your office, but eat with them. Drink with them. Not isolate yourself. All of this seemed admirable and sensible, but while he was talking to me, a sergeant came into the hall and asked the colonel where he could find a certain lieutenant. The colonel regarded him with ill-concealed contempt and said, "Can't you see that I am talking to an important individual here? Don't you know not to interrupt me when I am eating? Now get out of my sight." Then he continued with his discussion in the same didactic tone as before. The training course was meant to be 6 months, but after 8 weeks, I received a telegram from the ANC urgently requesting that I return home. The internal armed struggle was escalating, and they wanted the commander of MK on the scene. Colonel Tedesse rapidly arranged for me to take an Ethiopian flight to Khartoum. Before I left, he presented me with a gift, an automatic pistol and 200 rounds of ammunition. I was grateful, both for the gun and his instruction. Despite my fatigue marches, I found it wearying to carry around all that ammunition. A single bullet is surprisingly heavy. Hauling around 200 is like carrying a small child on one's back. In Khartoum, I was met by a British Airways official who told me that my connecting flight to Dar es Salaam would not leave until the following day, and they had taken the liberty of booking me into a posh hotel in town. I was dismayed, for I would have preferred to stay in a less conspicuous third-class hotel. When I was dropped off, I had to walk across the hotel's long and elegant veranda, where several dozen whites were sitting and drinking. This was long before metal detectors and security checks, and I was carrying my pistol in a holster inside my jacket and the 200 rounds wrapped around my waist inside my trousers. I also had several thousand pounds in cash. I had the feeling that all of these well-dressed whites had X-ray vision and that I was going to be arrested at any moment. But I was escorted safely to my room, where I ordered room service. Even the footsteps of the waiters put me on edge. From Khartoum, I went directly to Dar es Salaam, where I greeted the first group of 21 Umkhonto recruits who were headed to Ethiopia to train as soldiers. It was a proud moment, for these men had volunteered for duty in an army I was then attempting to create. They were risking their lives in a battle that was only just beginning, a battle that would be most dangerous for those who were its first soldiers. They were young men, mainly from the cities, and they were proud and eager. We had a farewell dinner. The men slaughtered a goat in my honor, and I addressed them about my trip and told them of the necessity of good behavior and discipline abroad, because they were representatives of the South African freedom struggle. Military training, I said, must go hand in hand with political training. For a revolution is not just a question of pulling a trigger. Its purpose is to create a fair and just society. It was the first time that I was ever saluted by my own soldiers. President Nyerere gave me a private plane to Mbeya, and I then flew directly to Lobatse. The pilot informed me that we would be landing in Kanye. This concerned me. Why was the plan altered? In Kanye, I was met by the local magistrate and a security man, both of whom were white. The magistrate approached me and asked me my name. "David Motsamai," I replied. "No," he said. "Please tell me your real name." Again, I said, "David Motsamai." The magistrate said, "Please tell me your real name because I was given instructions to meet Mr. Mandela here and provide him with help and transportation. If you are not Mr. Nelson Mandela, I am afraid I will have to arrest you, for you have no permit to enter the country. Are you Nelson Mandela?" This was a quandary. I might be arrested either way. "If you insist that I am Nelson Mandela and not David Motsamai," I said, "I will not challenge you." He smiled and said simply, "We expected you yesterday." He then offered me a lift to where my comrades would be waiting for me. We drove to Lobatse, where I met Joe Modise and an ANC supporter named Jonas Matlu, who was then living there. The magistrate told me that the South African police were aware that I was returning, and he suggested that I leave tomorrow. I thanked him for his help and advice, but when I arrived at Matlu's house, I said that I would leave tonight. I was to drive back to South Africa with Cecil Williams, a white theater director and member of MK. Posing as his chauffeur, I got behind the wheel, and we left that night for Johannesburg. Part 7. Rivonia. Chapter 49. After crossing the border, I breathed in deeply. The air of one's home always smells sweet after one has been away. It was a clear winter night, and somehow even the stars looked more welcoming here than from elsewhere on the continent. Though I was leaving a world where I experienced freedom for the first time, and returning to one where I was a fugitive, I was profoundly relieved to be back in the land of my birth and destiny. Between Bechuanaland and the northwestern Transvaal, dozens of unmarked roads traversed the border, and Cecil knew just which ones to take. During the drive, he filled me in on many of the events I had missed. We drove all night, slipping across the border just after midnight and reaching Lily's Leaf Farm at dawn. I was still wearing my beat-up khaki training uniform. Once at the farm, I did not have time for rest and reflection, because the following night we held a secret meeting for me to brief the working committee on my trip. Walter, Moses Kotani, Govan Mbeki, Dant Lume, J.B. Marks, and Duma Nokwe all arrived at the farm, a rare reunion. I first gave a general overview of my travels, itemizing the money we had received and the offers of training. At the same time, I reported in detail the reservations I had encountered about the ANC's cooperation with whites, Indians, particularly communists. Still ringing in my ears was my final meeting with the Zambian leaders, who told me that while they knew the ANC was stronger and more popular than the PAC, they understood the PAC's pure African nationalism, but were bewildered by the ANC's non-racialism and communist ties. I informed them that Oliver and I believed the ANC had to appear more independent to reassure our new allies on the continent, for they were the ones who would be financing and training Umkhonto we Sizwe. I proposed reshaping the Congress alliance so that the ANC would clearly be seen as the leader, especially on issues directly affecting Africans. This was a serious proposition, and the entire leadership had to be consulted. The working committee urged me to go down to Durban and brief the chief. All agreed except Govan Mbeki, who was not then living at Lily's Leaf Farm, but was present as part of the high command of MK. He urged me to send someone else. It was simply too risky, he said, and the organization should not jeopardize my safety, especially as I was newly returned and ready to push ahead with MK. This wise advice was overruled by everyone, including myself. I left the next night from Rivonia in the company of Cecil, again posing as his chauffeur. I had planned a series of secret meetings in Durban, the first of which was with Monty Naker and Ismail Mir, to brief them about my trip and to discuss the new proposal. Monty and Ismail were extremely close to the chief, and the chief trusted their views. I wanted to be able to tell Lutuli I had spoken to his friends and convey their reaction. Ismail and Monty, however, were disturbed by my belief that the ANC needed to take the lead among the Congress alliance and make statements on its own concerning affairs that affected Africans. They were against anything that unraveled the alliance. I was taken to Groutville, where the chief lived, and we met in the house of an Indian lady in town. I explained the situation to the chief at some length, and he listened without speaking. When I was done, he said he did not like the idea of foreign politicians dictating policy to the ANC. He said we had evolved the policy of non-racialism for good reasons, and he did not think that we should alter our policy because it did not suit a few foreign leaders. I told the chief that these foreign politicians were not dictating our policy, but merely saying that they did not understand it. My plan, I told him, was simply to effect essentially cosmetic changes in order to make the ANC more intelligible and more palatable to our allies. I saw this as a defensive maneuver, for if African states decided to support the PAC, a small and weak organization could suddenly become a large and potent one. The chief did not make decisions on the spur of the moment. I could see he wanted to think about what I had said and talk to some of his friends about it. I said farewell, and he advised me to be careful. I still had a number of clandestine meetings in the city and townships that evening. My last meeting that evening was with the MK Regional Command in Durban. The Durban Command was led by a sabotage expert named Bruno Mtolo, whom I had never met before, but would meet again under dramatically different circumstances. I briefed them on my trip to Africa, about the support we had received and the offers of training. I explained that for the moment MK was limited to sabotage, but that if sabotage did not have the desired effect, we would probably move on to guerrilla warfare. Later that same evening, at the home of the photojournalist G.R. Naidu, where I was staying, I was joined by Ismail and Fatima Mir, Monty Naker, and J.N. Singh for what was a combination welcome home party and going away party, for I was leaving the next day for Johannesburg. It was a pleasant evening and my first night of relaxation in a long while. I slept well, and I met Cecil on Sunday afternoon, the 5th of August, for the long drive back to Johannesburg in his trusty Austin. I wore my chauffeur's white dust coat and sat next to Cecil as he drove. We often took turns spelling each other behind the wheel. It was a clear, cool day, and I reveled in the beauty of the Natal countryside. Even in winter, Natal remains green. Now that I was returning to Johannesburg, I would have some time to see Winnie and the children. I had often wished that Winnie could share with me the wonders of Africa, but the best I could do was to tell her what I had seen and done. Once we left the industrial precincts of Durban, we moved through hills that offered majestic views of the surrounding valleys and the blue-black waters of the Indian Ocean. Durban is the principal port of the country's main industrial area, and the highway that leads to Johannesburg runs parallel to the railway line for a great distance. I went from contemplating the natural beauty to ruminating on the fact that the railway line, being so close to the highway, offered a convenient place for sabotage. I made a note of this in the small notebook I always carried with me. Cecil and I were engrossed in discussions of sabotage plans as we passed through Howick, 20 miles northwest of Pietermaritzburg. At Sedara, a small town just past Howick, I noticed a Ford V8 filled with white men shoot past us on the right. I instinctively turned round to look behind, and I saw two more cars filled with white men. Suddenly, in front of us, the Ford was signaling us to stop. I knew in that instant that my life on the run was over. My 17 months of freedom were about to end. As Cecil slowed down, he turned to me and said, "Who are these men?" I did not answer because we both knew full well who they were. They had chosen their hiding spot well. To the left of us was a steep wooded bank they could have forced us into had we tried to elude them. I was in the left-hand passenger seat, and for a moment I thought about jumping out and making an escape into the woods, but I would have been shot in a matter of seconds. When our car stopped, a tall, slender man with a stern expression on his face came directly over to the window on the passenger side. He was unshaven, and it appeared that he had not slept in quite a while. I immediately assumed he had been waiting for us for several days. In a calm voice, he introduced himself as Sergeant Vorster of the Pietermaritzburg Police and produced an arrest warrant. He asked me to identify myself. I told him my name was David Motsamai. He nodded, and then, in a very proper way, he asked me a few questions about where I had been and where I was going. I parried these questions without giving him much information. He seemed a bit irritated, and then he said, "Ag, you're Nelson Mandela, and this is Cecil Williams, and you are under arrest." He informed us that a police major from the other car would accompany us back to Pietermaritzburg. The police were not yet so vigilant in those days, and Sergeant Forster did not bother searching me. I had my loaded revolver with me, and again I thought of escape, but I would have been greatly outnumbered. I secretly put the revolver and my notebook in the upholstery between my seat and Cecil's. For some reason, the police never found the gun or the small notebook, which was fortunate, for many more people would have been arrested if they had. At the police station, I was led into Sergeant Forster's office, where I saw a number of officers, one of whom was Warrant Officer Truter, who had testified in the treason trial. Truter had made a favorable impression on the accused because he had accurately explained the policy of the ANC and had not exaggerated or lied. We greeted each other in a friendly way. I had still not admitted to anything other than the name David Motsamayi, and Truter said to me, "Nelson, why do you keep up this farce? You know I know who you are. We all know who you are." I told him simply that I had given a name, and that is the name I was standing by. I asked for a lawyer and was curtly refused. I then declined to make a statement. Cecil and I were locked in separate cells. I now had time to ruminate on my situation. I had always known that arrest was a possibility, but even freedom fighters practice denial, and in my cell that night I realized I was not prepared for the reality of capture and confinement. I was upset and agitated. Someone had tipped off the police about my whereabouts. They had known I was in Durban and that I would be returning to Johannesburg. For weeks before my return, the police believed that I was already back in the country. In June, newspaper headlines blared, "Return of the Black Pimpernel," while I was still in Addis Ababa. Perhaps that had been a bluff. The authorities had been harassing Winnie in the belief that she would know whether or not I was back. I knew that they had followed her and searched the house on a number of occasions. I guessed they had figured I would visit Chief Lutuli directly upon my return, and they were correct. But I also suspected they had information that I was in Durban at that time. The movement had been infiltrated with informers, and even well-intentioned people were generally not as tight-lipped as they should have been. I had also been lax. Too many people had known I was in Durban. I had even had a party the night before I left, and I chastised myself for letting down my guard. My mind ricocheted among the possibilities. Was it an informer in Durban? Someone from Johannesburg? Someone from the movement? Or even a friend or member of the family? But such speculation about unknowns is futile, and with the combination of mental and physical exhaustion, I soon fell deeply asleep. At least on this night, August 5th, 1962, I did not have to worry about whether the police would find me. They already had. In the morning, I felt restored, and I braced myself for the new ordeal that lay ahead of me. I would not, under any circumstances, seem despairing or even disappointed to my captors. At 8:30, I appeared before the local magistrate and was formally remanded to Johannesburg. It was low-key, and the magistrate seemed no more concerned than if he were handling a traffic summons. The police had not taken elaborate precautions for the trip back to Johannesburg or for my security, and I merely sat in the back seat of a sedan, unhandcuffed, with two officers riding in front. My arrest had been discovered by my friends. Fatima Mir brought some food to the jail for me, and I shared it with the two officers in the car. We even stopped at Volksrust, a town along the way, and they allowed me to take a brief walk to stretch my legs. I did not contemplate escape when people were kind to me. I did not want to take advantage of the trust they placed in me. But as we approached Johannesburg, the atmosphere changed. I heard an announcement over the police radio of my capture and the order to fold up the roadblocks to and from Natal. At sunset, on the outskirts of Johannesburg, we were met by a sizable police escort. I was abruptly handcuffed, taken from the car, and placed in a sealed police van with small opaque windows reinforced with wire netting. The motorcade then took a circuitous and unfamiliar route to Marshall Square, as if they were concerned we might be ambushed. I was locked in a cell by myself. In the quiet of the cell, I was planning my strategy for the next day when I heard a cough from a nearby cell. I did not realize a prisoner was close by. But more than that, there was something about this cough, something that struck me as curiously familiar. I sat up in sudden recognition and called out, "Walter?" "Nelson, is that you?" he said. And we laughed with an indescribable mixture of relief, surprise, disappointment, and happiness. Walter, I learned, had been arrested shortly after my own arrest. We did not think that the arrests were unrelated. While this was not the most auspicious place for a meeting of the National Working Committee, it was certainly convenient, and the night sped by as I gave him a full account of my arrest, as well as my meetings in Durban. The next day I appeared in court before a senior magistrate for formal remand. Harold Walpe and Joe Slovo had come to court after hearing of my arrest, and we conferred in the basement. I had appeared before this magistrate on numerous occasions in my professional capacity, and we had grown to respect one another. A number of attorneys were also present, some of whom I knew quite well. It is curious how one can be easily flattered in certain situations by otherwise insignificant incidents. I am by no means immune to flattery in normal circumstances, but there I was, a fugitive, number one on the state's most wanted list, a handcuffed outlaw who had been underground for more than a year, and yet the judge, the other attorneys, and the spectators all greeted me with deference and professional courtesy. They knew me as Nelson Mandela, attorney at law, not Nelson Mandela, outlaw. It lifted my spirits immensely. During the proceedings, the magistrate was diffident and uneasy, and would not look at me directly. The other attorneys also seemed embarrassed, and at that moment I had something of a revelation. These men were not only uncomfortable because I was a colleague brought low, but because I was an ordinary man being punished for his beliefs. In a way I had never quite comprehended before, I realized the role I could play in court and the possibilities before me as a defendant. I was the symbol of justice in the court of the oppressor, the representative of the great ideals of freedom, fairness, and democracy in a society that dishonored those virtues. I realized then and there that I could carry on the fight even within the fortress of the enemy. When I was asked the name of my counsel, I announced that I would represent myself with Joe Slovo as legal advisor. By representing myself, I would enhance the symbolism of my role. I would use my trial as a showcase for the ANC's moral opposition to racism. I would not attempt to defend myself so much as put the state itself on trial. That day, I answered only the questions as to my name and choice of counsel. I listened silently to the charges, inciting African workers to strike and leaving the country without valid travel documents. In apartheid South Africa, the penalties for these crimes could be as much as 10 years in prison. Yet the charges were something of a relief. The state clearly did not have enough evidence to link me with Umkhonto Wesizwe, or I would have been charged with the far more serious crimes of treason or sabotage. Only as I was leaving the courtroom did I see Winnie in the spectators' gallery. She looked distressed and gloomy. She was undoubtedly considering the difficult months and years ahead, of life on her own, raising 2 small children in an often hard and forbidding city. It is one thing to be told of possible hardships ahead. It is entirely another to actually have to confront them. All I could do, as I descended the steps to the basement, was to give her a wide smile, as if to show her that I was not worried, and that she should not be either. I cannot imagine that it helped very much. From the court, I was taken to the Johannesburg Fort. When I emerged from the courthouse to enter the sealed van, there was a crowd of hundreds of people cheering and shouting, "Amandla!" followed by "Ungawetu!" a popular ANC call and response meaning power, and "the power is ours." People yelled and sang and pounded their fists on the sides of the van as the vehicle crawled out of the courthouse exit. My capture and case had made headlines in every paper. Police swoop and